Welcome. I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. We've got a fun, action-packed show for you as usual. First up, right off the bat, we'll be talking to Dr. Gordon Edwards, who's the president, not just a member, but also the president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Dr. Gordon Edwards has been on the program before, where we've talked to him about a variety of nuclear issues, of course, that being his area of expertise. But we haven't talked to him in a while, so what we're doing today is we're having a little bit, he runs a through the CCNR, just a mail list of sending out articles and the major mainstream media about nuclear issues worldwide. He pays particular interest to Canada, so it's good good if you want to look up the CCNR if you were a nuclear issue interested person and get on their mailing list. Very, very informative, and he's I don't know how he does it. Almost no articles that ever get published seem to slip through his fingers. But so he's an excellent resource both through his expertise, which is in math and physics, and then 20 plus years of experience with nuclear issues, and of course very, very well read and stays up to date as well. So we're going to check in with him. One of the articles that came across my desk recently was talking about the fallout, both literally and metaphorically speaking, from the Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2 years ago in Japan. So we're going to do a bit of so what's happened with him since then on that issue about 2 years past on Fukushima. And then also we're going to relate that to ongoing refurbishment issues having to do with Darlington, for instance, in Ontario. So we're going to start with Across the Seas. We'll bring it back home for the end of that piece. Then we're going to go to some wonderful music, as usual, provided by DJ Amber Waves. Today, I particularly like it. I was in an ambient mood today, and she sent me some very ambient music, whose, in fact, the name of the artist is actually Ambisonic, so very perfect for that. And then in the second half, I wanted to wait. We actually recorded this interview a little while ago, but I wanted to wait because we're sort of working in concert with Alternatives Journal. I'm sure any regular listeners to the show have heard me mention Alternatives Journal many, many, many times, so we cooperate on projects whenever possible. So this was an interview that was actually done for the online version of their magazine. So if you want to go and actually read the article about Giles Slade, you can. A book we're going to be talking to him about that was also part of that article in Alternatives Journal was called The Big Disconnect. He was also the author of a few other books as well. Very interesting character, and I very much enjoyed my conversation with him. But what he's talking about with the Big Disconnect is that he's making comparisons throughout time as to how we've sort of lost a lot of our sense of our community, and this has been done through a lot of ways. For instance, everybody's sort of heard the, or is aware of, or have thought of the idea of how things like Facebook, for instance, are changing the dynamics of social relationships and interconnectedness, and he would argue for the worse. He would argue there's negative consequences, and in fact, he takes it a lot farther back than Facebook. He actually starts his talk with about how the personal music device, even as far back as the gramophone, started to change the dynamic in groups of people, and affects a lot the way that we relate to each other. So there's definitely an environmental connection there about distancing ourselves from what's actually going on, and the changing relationship of our not only our relationship with other individuals, but also our relationship with nature and our environment and how we interrelate as a cultural society. So that was very interesting as well. We will get to Gordon Edwards, who I believe is on the phone, in just a second. I want to make sure, while I've still got everybody's crystal clear attention as well, we have a very, very big announcement this week. We've done some shout outs before over the past 7 years. We do a couple of fundraisers a year. This is not another fundraiser. This is actually a really exciting opportunity to help the Green Majority take really huge step forward and become the next level. If there's any fans who we just finished listening to Democracy Now! Here on CIUT is the show that plays right before us. People who are fans of Democracy Now! Might know that they have a TV, if you will, version of it. They film everything in a proper studio. There's also shows you may be familiar with called things like The Young Turks on YouTube, The David Pakman Show. There's a whole bunch of them, kind of independent media, who have started basically finding their own sources of funding through people that appreciate the commentary and information that they're able to provide. We think we already do an amazing job of doing that, so we've decided we are going to be taking that plunge as well. We are not, underline, not fundraising for money at this point. What we're doing is we're actually going to be fundraising for video equipment at some point. What we're going to do, though, is use one of those websites like Indiegogo to do that, to do crowdsourcing for about the $8,000 to $10,000 we need to get the video equipment so we can start doing TV episodes, put them on YouTube, put them online, access a much, much, much larger community of people through that way. So all we're asking for at this point is we're not actually asking for donations yet. And we may not do that through the radio as well. That may may only be all through the social media. What we are looking for, that I definitely can advertise right here on CIUT's time anyway, is that right now what we're looking to do is make about a two-minute commercial to go on that campaign, a video commercial. So we've written a lot of it out. One of the scenes, we need a lot of people. We're going to have about 100 people to come and just show their support. So it would be a way that you could come down and be sort of in the video that launches the Green Majority's big-time project, getting right into the real time here with full video and live interviews and on-site reporting and really just taking the show to the next level. All we're asking at this point is for people to come down. We're going to be picking the exact day. It will likely be a weekend, actually, at this point. Near the end of May, probably in the first couple of days of June or the last week of May there, to just actually come down and just be in the video. So you can say, I was there and you were there right at the start. So that's a really exciting project. I'm gonna stop talking about it for now. We will mention it later in the show, but we'll give you a couple of seconds now just while we're getting started here to if you haven't already, go to the website. There's a big button on the website, greenmajority.ca, that says click here. We've also got, with all the information there, there's also a Facebook event page set up for it. We will be adding information in between the programs here as we do, but just for now, it doesn't mean you're committing to anything, but if you just go and add yourself to that group, or if you haven't already liked us on Facebook, go and add yourself to that group, and you can at least get the information as we start working on that project here in a more timely fashion. Invite your friends, invite your neighbors, bring your grandmom out, bring your dog, it's all good. We don't need as many people on this video as possible, so that's a really exciting project. I'm super, super pumped about it. We've got Poor Man's Media as well as Alex from Twitter is going to be helping us out with that as well. He's got quite a large following and does environmental video journalism as well, so he's going to be coming and helping us out with that project. So big shout out to him, and we're really, really happy that he's interested and on board with that project as well. So without further ado, I'll stop talking about it, but just while we get started here with Dr. Gordon Edwards, please do take an opportunity or make a note for yourself for later to go check out our Facebook page or just check out the website itself. There's a big button that says click here. You can do that. So without further ado, I believe I have Dr. Edwards on the line. Are you there, Gordon?
Yes, I'm here, Darren. How are you?
Thank you for bearing with my little commercial there for a minute.
All right, no problem. I hope the line is clear. Is it fine?
Yeah, I know you sound good to me. Maybe we'll just turn the volume up on you just a tiny, tiny bit there. You want to try again?
Okay, how's that?
There we go. I got you crystal clear. So it's been a little while since we've spoken, Gordon, and we had a great chat last time. It was really great, and you're coming through, and I've got hundreds of emails coming into my Green Majority account, and your name keep popping up, and I said, and I kept meaning to, you know, we should really get him back on. He was a great guest, and then the one across my desk here, that the title of the article from the New York Times you'd passed on, was "The Flow of Tainted Water is the Latest Crisis at Japan Nuclear Plant," and in the description of it, you'd said something about Fukushima 2 years past, and I said, you know what? Now's the time. We're going to get him back on the line. I hadn't even been personally. Fukushima had left my mind, a couple months ago, and I'd sort of moved on in my active memory to other issues. And I think I'm probably paying more attention than I think your average person is to what's going on. So I think that's a very standard reaction. Do you think most Canadians have forgotten about Fukushima at this point?
Well, unfortunately, I think people are mystified by the technology, and so they don't really understand that even 2 years into the accident, we're still facing major, major challenges. The TEPCO Corporation, that's the Tokyo Electric Power Corporation, built 7 huge underground tanks. They call them tanks, but really all they are is pits lined with polyethylene and a clay, bentonite clay. And they've been filling these pits. Each pit contains tens of thousands of gallons of radioactively contaminated water, too dangerous to release into the Pacific Ocean or anything else. And these tanks, these underground tanks, are now leaking. 3 of them, at least, of the 7 have been leaking. And so now they're building a whole series of above-ground tanks because the infiltration of water continues all the time. Groundwater is rushing into the damaged reactors. And as the groundwater comes in contact with the radioactive cores, which have melted down, they're becoming extremely radioactive. And so this water has to be stored in new pits. So what they're now doing is they're cutting down a whole small forest in order to build above-ground tanks that they can put these wastes into. They've decided that the below-ground tanks were a failure. So now they're building above-ground tanks. And they're still trying to save money because the whole thing is enormously expensive. And the actual cleanup of the site, The International Atomic Energy Agency says now that it will take more than 40 years to even deal with these problems.
One of the things, just while you were describing there with the pits, it really reminded me of also what's been going on in Alberta as well with the quote-unquote tailing ponds there. They've chosen the word ponds for those, when in reality they're kilometers wide. Does it not seem to imply to a certain degree that when we're using language, which is something I'm always paying careful attention to, is people's choice of words there, is that there seems to be an implicit knowledge that they understand that Canadians would be really upset about these sorts of issues, or the Japanese in the case of what's going on there. But, I mean, just in general, we can relate it back to Darlington and everything about that, about these careful choices of languages that have been done to try and either mystify and make it less comprehensible or reduce the impact, seems to be a tacit admission that they know that Canadians wouldn't be for this if they really knew what was going on.
Well, exactly. I mean, they use language which is, well, they talk about nuclear safety instead of nuclear hazards. They talk about spent fuel instead of irradiated fuel. Because the fact of the matter is that when the fuel is irradiated in a nuclear reactor, what comes out of the reactor is millions of times more radioactive than what went in the first place. And the reason for this is because inside the reactor there is a splitting of atoms, a fissioning process, where uranium atoms are being split, and you get hundreds of broken pieces of uranium atoms, which are intensely radioactive, far more radioactive than the uranium itself. And these are the materials which are causing so much problem over the long term. They're going to be dangerous for literally hundreds of thousands to millions of years. And that's what's in this contaminated water. Another thing that people don't understand is that when you shut down a reactor, people think, oh, good, now it's shut off, now it's safe. No, it's not safe. The reason is because you cannot shut off the radioactivity. And the radioactivity alone is so intense that it has to be cooled, that is, the irradiated fuel inside the reactor, has to be cooled for at least 5 to 10 years before it can be safely taken out of the wet pools that they're stored in. So what we have here is a situation where heat is being generated in an unstoppable fashion. There's no way you can shut off this heat because it's due to radioactivity alone. And that's why they have to use more and more and more water to try and remove the heat. But the water, it's sort of like the reverse Midas touch. Everybody's heard the story of the Midas touch, where King Midas, whatever he touches, turns to gold, but he ends up starving to death because he can't eat food. As soon as he touches food, it turns to gold. Well, this is the reverse Midas touch. Everything turns to radioactive crap as soon as it touches the reactor core. And the result is that that you really have a serious problem. Now, a lot of this stuff went into the Pacific Ocean originally, in the opening weeks of the accident. Now they're trying to contain it, but they're having great difficulties doing so, and the radiation levels at the perimeter of the plant have already crept up to the point where they can no longer maintain the standards which they were hoping to maintain for radiation levels. So it's really a terrible mess. Now, one has to ask the question, you know, many people think, well, God, why do they build these reactors in such an earthquake-sensitive area? Well, we might ask the same question. Why are we building nuclear reactors right on the shores of the Great Lakes? Imagine if such an accident were to happen at a reactor along the Great Lakes. Where would all that water go? Well, instead of going into the Pacific Ocean, it would go right into the Great Lakes, which is the source of drinking water for 40 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a reasonable approach would be to say that let's take a lesson from this and not allow any more nuclear reactors to be built along the shores of the Great Lakes. There's just no way it should be built there.
Another graphic that I saw, Gordon, was that really just it stuck in my mind. The image burned itself into my mind because it was such a shocker for me. I may be mistaken here, but I believe it was actually in a Toronto Star article from a few years ago. And what they were showing was it was specifically for Darlington Nuclear Reactor. And they were showing that at the point of construction, people that were within the mild, medium, and major sort of hazard zone, if there was a meltdown, they have those, you know, they have the like the hazard map saying, you know, if there was a problem, here's the affected area. And what they did was they overlapped the people that were living within those three zones, I guess for this, just sort of like check to see sort of what the hazards would be, what the fallout would be, again, pun intended. And the difference between who was living there when they built it and how many people are living within those zones now. And it's gone from like thousands of people to hundreds of thousands of people are now living within the danger zone of these factories, probably completely unaware that they're in a danger zone.
Well, if you take the Pickering reactors, which are much closer to Toronto, that evacuation zone would cut right into the heart of Toronto. So you'd be having to talk about the evacuation of Toronto. You know, we're talking about maybe 20 miles to Pickering, whereas Tokyo was 150 miles away from Fukushima, and there was serious consideration of evacuating Tokyo, which, of course, would be an impossibility. Well, I don't think the government would be able to evacuate Toronto either. So I think we're dealing here with a situation where either we learn the lessons of the past or we don't. And, of course, a lot of people also are comforting themselves by saying, well, we're not going to have, like, a tsunami on Lake Ontario, so we're safe. That's false hope, because, in fact, it wasn't the tsunami itself that caused all this damage to the reactors. It was self-inflicted damage caused by simply a lack of electrical power. If the electrical power systems are wiped out for any reason whatsoever for a prolonged period of time, reactors are going to melt down. And the reason for that is because, as I said before, there's so much heat being generated by the radioactivity that it's more than enough to melt the core of the reactor. So in Sweden, for example, just a couple of years ago, they had a problem where there was a grid failure, so there was a power blackout. And they tried to start up the emergency generators. The first one would not start, the second one would not start, and the third one they had trouble starting, and finally they got it started, and they were only 7 minutes away from a meltdown.
Wow.
And the reason for that was not anything to do with the tsunami. It was simply due to the fact that temporarily they were out of electrical power to run the pumps to cool the reactor, and if that reactor core is not cooled, even if it's shut down completely, it's going to melt. So we have this problem that is a generic problem. It's a problem of all nuclear reactors, and it's one that I think people have got to stand up and say, no more new reactors along the Great Lakes, at least.
So, Gordon, I think this is the perfect time. There was one question I rarely write questions ahead of time, but there was one I kind of came in packing today. And one was, when I was doing research for this and I was looking around at different articles, some of the ones that you'd posted and a little bit of my own, I'm still to this day, and I've been seeing it for years, but I'm sort of, I guess I was surprised to see, still to this day, there are still groups you can find websites that will come up. I don't know how many people there are. I don't know how much big support there is. I don't know how legitimate they are. But you'll still find websites for, you know, concerned environmentalists for nuclear power. Now, I guess it's admittedly very unfair to ask someone who's has a lot of concerns about this technology, or at least how it's being used, to kind of strawman the other person's argument. But, I mean, in seeing as I don't have access to any of those people today, what arguments could be made? Where are these arguments that nuclear is still a better environmental option coming from? Could you at least try to paraphrase their arguments, or at least sort of maybe say why you think that there's still so many people saying that?
Well, when I was in high school, I learned about, there was a Walt Disney film that we saw in high school called Our Friend the Atom, and it showed the friendly giant, the atom as a giant, sort of putting all kinds of good things with a smiling face.
Kevin hasn't talked yet, but he's nodding his head. I think he might have seen it as well.
And the idea of this is that nuclear energy was portrayed as being clean, safe, cheap, and abundant. And consequently, I was in favor of nuclear power as a teenager because that's all I knew about it, was that it's safe, clean, cheap, and abundant. And if that's all you know, or that's all you think you know, then why would you not be in favor of it? The point is, however, that this is based upon ignorance. It's ignorance of the technology. Because how can you say that a technology is safe when there's no off switch, when you cannot, in fact, turn it off? Like most machines, if they start going in a dangerous trend, you reach for the off switch and bang, you shut it off, and thank God you saved the day. You know?
Sure, there's a factory. There's those big red buttons to shut down the machines if somebody gets caught.
And how many thrillers have been made by Hollywood where they just disconnect the bomb at the last second and that sort of saves the day? Mm. Well, the problem with nuclear power is there's no way to shut it off safely and walk away from it. You just can't do that. Mm. So inherently, this is a very dangerous machine. The other thing, of course, is that in addition to mass-producing electricity, which is a good thing, and we like to use it for our society, we need it, but there's many, many other ways of generating electricity which do not simultaneously mass-produce dangerous, toxic poisons which basically last forever. And that's the problem with nuclear power, is that while it's producing electricity, it's actually creating a huge, enormous inventory of highly toxic radioactive material which cannot be neutralized or destroyed by any method known to science. And as a result, it's going to remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands to millions of years, far longer than the span of human history. But the worst thing about it, and this is the thing that bothers me the most, is that as we've seen with recent developments in Iran and North Korea, is that anybody who has access to so-called peaceful technology, that is nuclear reactors and uranium enrichment, can also use that technology to produce atomic bombs. So while we're spreading this peaceful technology around the world, we're spreading the capability of building atomic bombs, and we're literally sowing the seeds of our own destruction. So all these considerations add to that the fact that they can't even pay the bills. The nuclear people require constant subsidies. Private money simply won't invest in it. They even have, for example, every insurance policy has an exclusion clause saying you are not covered in the event of a nuclear accident. And while the nuclear proponents, the people who propose nuclear power and say we definitely should build more, they don't point out that that even though they tell people that they are crazy to worry about an accident because it's not going to happen, they nevertheless go to the government and require a special law to protect them against financial liability precisely in the case of such an accident. So even though they say that you shouldn't worry about it, they're worried enough about it to get a special law passed to protect them.
So we've only got another minute or so left there, Gordon. Unfortunately, time's been flying by, and we're on a bit of a compacted schedule today. But I want to get one more question in there, which is that when I was looking around, I couldn't really find any poll data or anything like that. But this is your issue. I feel maybe you've got your finger a little bit closer to the button than I do. Do you have any sense of how Canadians poll on these issues, or I guess specifically in Ontario, seeing as that's where the majority of the nuclear activity is? Do you know how the public feels about this? Are they generally? My impression, I should say, has been that most people don't understand it, and therefore they don't really have an opinion.
Right.
What is your impression been?
Well, my impression is that the informed opinion is largely opposed or certainly concerned. The people who are in favor of it often know very little about it. They know very little about the specific technology, the specifics of the technology that make it dangerous. That's because there has been no public education on the point. However, the government of Ontario announced just this week that they're going to consider delaying the implementation of any new nuclear reactors at Darlington, for example. And I think now is a very opportune time for people to become active and speak out and write to the government of Ontario, write to the government of Canada, and say, we don't want our ratepayers' money and our taxpayers' money going to subsidize this industry. They've already given $1 billion in contracts to SNC-Lavalin. Anybody who's been following the fortunes of SNC-Lavalin knows how plagued with corruption that company is. They've already been given $1 billion in contracts simply to prepare a plan for refurbishing the existing Darlington reactors. I think people should object to this and say, hey, this is not a good way to spend our money.
Yeah. I'll take a couple of wind turbines personally, but that's just me. I'm afraid that is all the time.
Well,
we have
imagine what $1 billion could do if it was invested in renewable energy.
And sorry, let me just be clear about the $1 billion. Is this an like a provincial level or a federal level $1 billion?
No, this is provincial. This is
wow.
Provincially.
Okay, so
$1 billion given to SNC-Lavalin just to do paper studies.
Yeah, the relevance of that number, just to put it in context, just went up highly. I thought you meant it at a federal level, but if that's just
no.
A provincial project, that's wow. That's a huge number.
Right.
So I sort of lied. I have one final question for you, but it's a bit of a gotcha. we're promoting our new project today. I don't know if you heard my commercial on the intro there to the show. So I've got sort of a joking question for you, which was, would you support a Green Majority TV show? Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think people should come out and support us getting our own video equipment?
Absolutely. I think it's very important that alternative voices, especially in this day when there's so much corporate control of the media, and there's so little independence of journalists these days. We really need to have independent voices, and the Green Majority would be a great addition to that.
Well, I've always been a big fan of Fox News' tagline, so Kevin Farmer's here in the studio. He's fair, I'm balanced, and that's all the time we have for this interview, I'm afraid. But I want to thank you again very, very much, Dr. Gordon Edwards, who, of course, is the president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. And people, where can they go and get put on your mailing list if they want to get email about all these articles?
Well, we've got a website at www.ccnr.org, and there's an email at the bottom of every page, an email connection, And that goes to me, and I will put you on our mailing list if you want to get more information, and there's lots of information already on our website. If you go to the Essays and Answers section of our website, these are articles written by myself dealing with some of these issues.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much again for your time. We are going to go to a music break, folks, but stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Leisure Time by Ambisonic. We are back. That was Ambisonic. I am Darren Kaster, your host of The Green Majority. We were just hearing from Dr. Gordon Edwards from the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. I still have Giles Slade coming up with his new book, which is called The Big Disconnect. But we've got our interlude at the moment now. I've got Kevin Farmer here sitting in the studio. He's got a massive coffee sitting in front of him. I'm assuming you're all pepped up, Kevin. What do you got for us?
Well, hi, Darren. Today, I just want to communicate some sort of basic realities about climate change feedback mechanisms. I've mentioned them before on the show. I've alluded to my personal concern about thawing permafrost. But lately I've been doing a lot of reading, specifically, you know, I haven't really updated my knowledge on this topic in a while. I did a lot of research a few years ago, and I became well acquainted with the various feedback mechanisms that could potentially come into play in the climate change scenario. And I just sort of spent the last 2 weeks really updating my information, and you know, in the intervening years, things have not gotten any better.
I totally thought you were going to say, and it turns out we're totally fine.
Yeah, no.
Oh, man.
It definitely is not the case, and I think it's really important that people come to understand this.
And so what sorts of things had you noticed just in your research from a few years ago versus sort of what you'd looked at now? Was there any specific things that really jumped out at you as like, oh, that's a lot worse than it used to be? Or did you find anything that had maybe either the situation had improved or our understanding had improved and it wasn't as bad as we thought it was? Any of that?
Oh, God, no. No, in fact, routinely, so, you know, environmentalists have been branded as alarmists and hysterics, you know, since the 70s, and they're afraid of that label. It's a conversation stopper. They're very shy about being branded as alarmists, especially climate scientists. And we've seen over and over and over again that their projections have been too conservative. Mm-hmm. You know, the ice is melting much faster than anyone predicted. The planet's warming faster than anyone predicted. The carbon sinks that we were hoping would buy us some time seem to be failing well ahead of schedule. You know, that they've ceased to perform as carbon sinks, and now so more of our emissions are staying in the atmosphere now because some natural buffers are full. I can't think of any more off the top of my head, but it's just been every single time that a prediction of the climate change model has been verified, it seems to be always the case that it's been found out that prediction was in fact too conservative.
I remember one of the things that I've noticed is sort of a running joke where people say, you know, when there was concerns about IPCC numbers, you know, having been massaged, and, you know, the quote unquote faking of the hockey stick graph and the big quote unquote scandal with those letters that were found at the university and all that sort of stuff, is that, you know, most people in the know, most people who have either, you know, had secondary education, post-secondary level education on the issue, or, you know, any sort of fairly good understanding of the actual science, has been that, you know what, when you're looking at it and you talk to any of these scientists, the reaction is usually that if these numbers were massaged at all, they were reduced because they didn't think people would believe what the numbers said.
Well, this is the thing, and this is why I'm almost sort of proactively pessimistic, is because the spin on environmental issues is to try and soft pedal the message so that people will not overreact to it. You know, you've got to preach hope, essentially. It's like political messaging. You've got to be preaching hope rather than despair, or else people won't buy into what you're selling.
We can't be anti-guns. We've got to be pro-safety.
Yeah, exactly. And
which is sort of the same argument, but I think it does the same thing. It deludes what it is you're actually trying to achieve when you're switching your language around. And
well, even prominent, you know, climate campaigners will. I mean, you know, I was watching, you know, The Agenda with Steve Paikin recently, and a well-known climate campaigner, Keith Stewart, was for the climate change campaigner for Greenpeace, was on the show, and he calmly stated that, you know, he was on the show against four other sort of pro-carbon voices, which I thought was a real mismatch as far as, you know, lining up guests for that conversation to take place. But he calmly pointed out to everyone at the table, he corrected some what was being said, and he rather calmly pointed out that according to the International Energy Agency, we're on track for a 6-degree rise in temperatures. And no one stops to say, holy crap, 6 degrees rise in temperature. That hasn't existed in 100 million years since the center of the earth was desertified and dinosaurs were grazing on polar rainforests. A 6-degree rise in temperature is an utter catastrophe. It's a civilization ending event. We would be reduced to hunter gatherers struggling for existence at the poles of the planet. Even the target, the internationally agreed upon target of 2 degrees Celsius of warming, what's been lost while that term's been bandied about over and over and over again, one, we're not going to meet that target, so don't anyone get their hopes up that we're going to meet the target of constraining the rise in temperature to 2 degrees Celsius. But 2 degrees Celsius is what that target represents, is the point at which it is estimated that our chances of avoiding dangerous climate change are 50-50. So even what we're shooting for still has a 50-50 chance of being an utter disaster.
The Russian roulette metaphors are just streaming through my mind, but I'll let you keep talking.
Yeah, it's like loading half the chambers in a game of Russian roulette. If you want me to go into the permafrost thing now or later,
I think we've got a couple minutes. Why don't you go into the permafrost?
Okay, so what's going on is the planet's warming. So permafrost is frozen ground, basically. And what happens with plant material when it dies there is that it freezes as well. And so there's enormous amounts of frozen organic material stored in the Earth's permafrost. What happens is this permafrost thaws, which is what it's doing right now, is that organic matter starts to decompose. If it decomposes in the presence of oxygen, carbon dioxide is produced. If it decomposes in the absence of oxygen, methane is produced. And methane is 22 times more effective as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And you have to assume, since only the top layer of permafrost is exposed to the atmosphere, that the vast majority of thawing tundra is going to produce methane.
And one of the, just from my climate change class, I know a retort someone might make to that if they were, say, sitting opposed to you on the CBC roundtable or something like that might be, well, yes, but if I'm correct, methane is stays, it's less, quote unquote, less damaging because it dissipates faster. I said, yeah, but do you have any concept of just how much of it there is?
Yeah, exactly.
That's like saying, you know, it's like, well, a hand grenade isn't as dangerous as a fire because, you know, it's over in 2 seconds. Yeah, but it depends how many people are standing next to it.
Well, yeah, and that's actually a point I'll get to. So it's estimated that there's 1.7 trillion tons of carbon stored in the permafrost. That's twice the existing global atmospheric inventory of carbon from all sources. And by carbon, in this case, I mean carbon dioxide. So if say all of the carbon in the permafrost were to be released as carbon dioxide, which isn't going to happen, we would at least triple the existing inventory of greenhouse gases. But the fact is it's going to be released as methane for the most part. And so we could effectively multiply the greenhouse gas inventory many, many times. Well, not many, many times over, but say up to 20 times over. We could, you know, just dramatically increase the inventory. So what's going on, though, is that, so it's a feedback mechanism, because as the methane and the carbon dioxide get released, the temperatures rise. As the temperatures rise, more permafrost thaws. As more permafrost thaws, more greenhouse gases are released. And we're talking about a contribution to climate change that so thoroughly dwarfs our own that if this process becomes self-sustaining, shutting off all of the anthropogenic sources of greenhouse gases tomorrow won't stop it, because it just dwarfs our own contribution. There's no way to put that genie back in the bottle. And the punchline of the story is that some new research has indicated that the point at which this process will become irreversible is at a rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's the point at which people who are studying this believe the permafrost feedback mechanism will be irreversible. So even that target of 2 degrees, we've warmed 0.8 degrees since pre-industrial times. So we're more than halfway to the 1.5 degree target tipping point. If we were to cease all anthropogenic emissions tomorrow, the atmosphere would still continue to warm for hundreds of years. It's called climate commitment. It takes a while for things to heat up once, you know, we've hit 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere now. But we're not going to feel the effects of that right away. It takes time. It just takes time to heat up a planet. And so we're already committed to a certain increase past where we already are, even if we shut everything down tomorrow. And I looked up as many scenarios as I could find, and all of the projections of climate commitment, there's varying ranges of climate commitment, but all of them take us past the 1.5 degree rise at which the permafrost feedback mechanism is estimated to be irreversible.
So, and unfortunately, we will have to leave it there, but I'm going to just leave you on one note, which is that I love that language, climate commitment. I think this should be part of a new campaign, because everybody knows that your average man is terrified of commitment, right? So we'll just keep calling it climate commitment, and maybe we'll solve this problem overnight. Anyway, we'll have to figure out something else for the women, but I think you're on a roll there. So anyway, we're going to check in with you next week. I know you had a lot more there. We just dealt with permafrost a little bit. We'll come back and we'll check in with some of the other stuff you've been looking at next week, but we've got to move on now just to make sure that we get time for our last feature. So we're going to take just 30 seconds of a music break as a segue here to let you digest that. Also to give you a chance to go to the website, greenmajority.ca, and look up the readout, because I don't have time in the show right now to go through the special offer that we're offering here. So if you missed it at the beginning of the show, either just go to greenmajority.ca, click on the priority update link, or go to our Facebook page and look for the event page that we've created, or you can just go anything, or you could call me, you can email me, do anything you like, but we need to get you involved. We're going to take a really quick music break for like 30 seconds, and we'll be back with Giles Slade. We'll be right back. right, so we've got to keep moving. This is Darren Kaster with the Green Majority here. We're actually running really close on time, so I'm not going to give him the full intro. This was an interview I did with Giles Slade, who's the author of The Big Disconnect for Alternatives Journal. Without further ado, just because we're running tight on time, we're going to go to the interview, but there will be full show notes on and on after the program. So without further ado, here's Giles Slade. One of the things that was the biggest theme of sort of all of your work is that, I haven't seen you described this way, but I would put you very much as a social critic. Would you disagree with that assessment?
I guess not. I started writing these because I wondered, how we'd got into this mess, and I didn't really even have a very concrete way to describe the mess. I was trying to describe the mess as I was trying to sort of explain it historically, and so yeah, it's become social criticism, and at least in one dimension, and that's I guess the reason for either my limited popularity or my massive unpopularity. I'm not trying to write Jeremy ads or anything like that, but I think we've invented this terrible way of living, and compared to other cultures that I've lived in, I've lived in six countries. We've sort of painted ourselves into a corner, and so I want to know, how we did that, what precisely, the corner is all about, and how to get out of it.
So your most recent book, The Big Disconnect, talks a lot about the social disconnect of, among other things, among many things. You talk a lot about music and the invention of the gramophone and just even the concept of portable music. You also get into more recent modern day developments, things like Facebook and Twitter and all these sorts of things. Can you just describe quickly just the effect that what actually has happened? What has happened to society and to interpersonal relationships due to Facebook? I kind of understand. I'm not quite as clear on where the gramophone comes in, if you want to just explain that.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's just a very specific example of how we have invented and used technology to support and encourage our social isolation. There's this broad sort of historical curve from, maybe the 1830s, 1850s onwards, where cities increased in size. More and more people moved into cities from the country and of course from other countries, and as this was happening, we invented technologies to sustain the connection that we once had with the families that we left in our countries or in the old countries. And so photographs, telephone calls, gramophone records, which were originally used to send messages, all came up, in a very close period of time in the maybe 1860s, 1870s, and so technology became a way to divert ourselves from our loneliness. And as our increasing invention of these kinds of technologies took hold, and as we became acclimatized to them, we began to use them increasingly to divert ourselves. Both from the feelings of loneliness and isolation that we experienced in the new environment of the city, and also to prevent ourselves from making new connections, because these diversions became increasingly good, satisfying, and powerful. And so, when you walk across the urban grid, listening to your iPhone or your iPad, listening to music, you're getting the same biochemical sort of hit that you get from joining a choir or making music in a group of human beings, but your social skills and your social network is not reinforced by them. So it's kind of like a pacifier. It does what a nipple does, but it's not nearly as satisfying.
When I was thinking about music and connections to people and interrelatedness, something that I like to do and something that people that I know like to do is go out and, for instance, well, once in a while do karaoke. But karaoke is something where you'll find that there's always one or two that are super keen, and then a whole bunch of other people get dragged along because that's what's going on. And then there's a couple of people that, whether they end up there or not, absolutely will not. It seems to be among the list of the top 10, kind of social phobias is being forced to sing in public. But it occurs to me, if I'm reading from some of the stuff that you're here, that this is a very new development. This is something that was very intrinsically part of our social culture until very, very recently.
There was, a lot more bad music in the old days, but you know, it was prevalent. It was one of the things that that we did to divert ourselves. There wasn't any TV, you know. People sat around and told stories, or you know, played board games, or you know, made music with simple musical instruments, fiddles and mouth organs, and you know, washboard basses and stuff like that, guitars, and you know, maybe the standard wasn't nearly as high as your average indie band, but you know, it was something that maybe as many as 70%, 80% of people participated in some way, and many evenings a week, and so it was a vehicle for social connection. And also, there's the biochemical aspect of it. When you create music with another person, the trust hormone oxytocin is released, and you bond with them in a very close way, which is something that doesn't happen with you know, pre-recorded music, because of course you're listening to it alone.
I'm wondering about how, when people go to use these sorts of technologies, let's move more kind of back up to the present time now, and we're talking about things like Facebook and Twitter and that sort of idea. Uh-huh. When you, for instance, when you sign up for the now more or less defunct website, for instance, MySpace, for instance, you would immediately get a friend request from this gentleman named Tom, who's the creator of this site, and it seems to be on its face very... They aren't being disguised, I guess what I'm trying to say is they aren't being disguised as actual, taking the place of actual relationships. They don't appear to attempt to be replacing them, but they essentially have. Why do you think that inner relationships that are clearly not the same as the types of relationships you'd have with someone in purpose, in that you actually knew, like a friend, how do you think this sort of obviously fake sort of social network has so successfully replaced actual relationships?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of things going on. There are less opportunities to meet people in meaningful ways, and to create friendships. Friendships require time, and not everybody has time, because or very few people have time, because we're all busily trying to pay for those labor-saving devices. But as we became acclimatized and acculturated to isolating ourselves in the urban setting, because we have so many daily contacts that we can't manage them all, we're really only wired, some people say for 120 or 150, we're really only wired for that many people in our immediate community. And if, you know, I don't know where you're living in Toronto, downtown Toronto, I mean, you see that many people if you leave your office and go out to buy a cup of coffee and come back, you know. You need to distance yourself, because you just can't handle it. There's a kind of overload. And so one way of handling it evolved in the 60s, which was kind of a very brief sort of recognition and then turning away. But even that, you know, in the modern city can, you know, consume all of your emotional energy for the whole day long. So now, you know, you walk through the streets with earphones in your ears, or, you know, staring into an iPhone, at texting someone you're close to, and this isolates you from making these contacts in the city. But those contacts are actually, you know, an opportunity to make friends, and so our opportunities to make friends are reduced. The social skills required to make friends are reduced, and our satisfaction and maybe acculturation to using these devices instead of using friends is increased. So although we often feel a lack, maybe kind of a hole in our lives, we don't know really what's supposed to go in there. And, you know, of course, what's supposed to go in there is lasting, meaningful social relationships, which are not always happy. Friends can be very annoying, but, you know, it's the proximity that counts. You know?
Yeah.
And, have that. I mean, you know, how many times has your best friend pissed you off? With, I don't know, just by saying overly personal things in public or something like that, you know, just
sure.
what friends do, you know, but we've kind of lost our tolerance for that, you know, whereas, you know, he does it three times, and then you think, okay, I got to get a new friend. Okay, you know, this guy is not what I thought he was, you know, so our, you know, the duration of friendships is greatly reduced. And I think the duration of friendship is reduced, began to become reduced when we lost our relationship to material goods. We don't keep, you know, hoard material goods and reuse them in a variety of different ways. Instead, we, you know, just throw them out, and we do the same thing with people.
Why? Would this be part of, I mean, you're talking a lot, you're talking about, you know, not valuing physical goods, and your previous book was talking a lot about planned obsolescence and just this, between the two of them, there's kind of a general theme of disregarding and throwing away objects, and also in the same sense, you know, to, well, it's easier to get rid of this friend or to get rid of this partner because I can just grab another one. Is it all part of the same mindset? Is it all part of just a disposable planet kind of mindset that we're all in?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've systematically shut down our empathy, and also we've shut down our sense of responsibility through time. So, you know, relationships are no longer things to be grown. Material goods are no longer things to be crafted and cherished. You know, things that acquire a patina over time, they're things to be replaced. And I think, you know, the reason we do this is because we've assigned a monetary value to almost everything in our lives. And with that kind of one-dimensional worldview of consumerism, we don't see we don't stop and smell the roses anymore. You know, we don't value a sunset, although we might value it during our commute out of the car window for 5 minutes before we get home, and you know, throw ourselves down on the couch in front of the TV.
We do stop and watch the cat video. We just may not stop for the roses.
And you know, we've impoverished ourselves, you know, and it's very sad. And other, you know, parts of the world where people are much poorer than us in terms of material goods, they're actually much richer in terms of you know, their personal connections and the satisfaction of the quality of their life, you know. And I find this. I mean, when I returned, I started writing Made to Break when I came back from the Arab world in 2001, and just was really struck by the, I don't know if I can say this on your radio.
If you can't, we'll edit it out.
Oh, okay, good. Well, the sort of FU next, you know, or, you know, the sort of a complete lack of conversation or exchange while you're, you know, in a retail outlet buying something, and sort of, you know, get through this transaction as quickly as possible, supersize it if you can, and then, you know, get on to the next one. Whereas, you know, in the Arab world, you're playing a game with a person who's selling you something, you know, even if it's for a few pennies, you know, and you're establishing this kind of clever social connection that carries on into, you know, the next exchange, you know.
So one of the things we've talked about now is we've talked about some of the social disconnectedness. We've talked about how that applies to, you know, old technology, new technology, and sort of this path of increasingly being disconnected towards both people and objects around us. So what I want to ask you now is okay. So I mean, you've got a good example, I think, from a minute ago of just the idea of a disposable mentality and just sort of throwing things away and not thinking and not valuing the individual object, but simply in a way almost valuing its function, but not its form. In that its form can be replaced. But so what are the actual consequences then? I guess to that, I would say, okay, I've been convinced. So what?
Oh well, gee. Well, they're massive. You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's my age or you know, I'm 59, turning 60, and I'm just starting to, you know, reach out for the first time in many years to make new friends and you know, and sort of build a community around me and my family, which is, you know, it's possible to do, but it's very time-consuming, and so, you know, you have to change your priorities completely. But also, you know, the consequences are disastrous, not just in a personal term. They're disastrous in terms of our physical well-being and you know, our ability to survive the future. You know, so there's this, I mean, I don't think, you know, even the fundamental people in the United States deny climate change anymore. It's pretty, you know, there are megastorms lashing the coast, and there are, you know, tornadoes coming down many miles of, north of Tornado Alley in January, you know, and much more powerful tornadoes than have ever existed before. There are all kinds of things happening. The Arctic ice cap is melting, you know, the sea levels are rising much quicker than, you know, than we have ever experienced before, and you know, I don't know what year the drought in the southwest during the United States is. It must be the fifth year of full drought now, but it was very bad last year, and it's going to be even worse this year. And so we've set ourselves on this course in order to, you know, achieve this level of material comfort that that's, you know, the basis of consumerism, but that also impoverishes our lives because it eliminates the kind of interpersonal dimension.
All right. So unfortunately, we're still missing about a minute or two of the show there, but I'm at risk of infringing on my friend there, Time, who's got a great show coming up, and I don't want to take even a moment of her amazing music show. So if you're not listening on CIUT, then you're about to miss Talia Newman, which you should go to her website instead. But people who are, you've got her coming up. Always a good thing. We've had a bit of an information-heavy show today, so I'm happy to have Talia come on and play some, I'm sure, great music afterwards, and we'll cheer everybody back up. But you can, of course, remember, keep in mind our special projects. Please do go to the website. Please check it out. This is the biggest favor I've ever asked of our audience. More important, in my personal opinion, than our fundraising drives here at CIUT, because this is really the beginning of something massive I think we can get going here. I really could use your help, so please go to greenmajority.ca, click on the Click Here Priority Update button, and you can stay connected to all the further information. We'll be making announcements on air, but we'll be keeping it more up to date on the website and on the Facebook page. So without further ado, that was your show. Thank you very much to Gordon Edwards and Giles Slade, and of course Kevin Farmer, who is here in studio as well, who will be back next week along with myself. So have a great week, and we'll talk to everyone next week. Stay tuned.